by a sort of fatalistic madness, turning over the mutilated corpses and peering into their faces until he'd checked every body that littered the avenue, until his hands were covered in the blood of innocents. Then he shuffled to the next street and began again. The distant screaming had stopped during his search, and the only sounds were that of his own hoarse breaths, the crackling of fires throughout the city, and the almost imperceptible wheeze let out by each corpse as he moved them, as if the dead were trying to speak to him. But if they spoke, it was in a language he did not know. Not yet. After a time, a shout broke the near silence. Alesh turned and saw five redeemers approaching on the other end of the street, watching him the way one might watch a wild animal that has escaped its pen. His hand was on the hilt of his sword before he knew it. His chest heaved, not with fear, but with a sudden, implacable fury, demanding vengeance. The men must have seen something of the madness lurking in his gaze, for they hesitated as he turned to them, a silent snarl twisting his face, the blood of the city's dead covering him. He took a step toward them, his mouth twisting into a cruel grin. Then a single thought broke through the red haze that had settled on his thoughts. Sonya, you have to find her. He teetered, shaking with the anger, the hate that begged to be released. She's counting on you, the voice told him. Erwin's counting on you. All right, he thought, all right. He would wait, for now. But when it was done, he promised himself he'd butcher every man that dared to wear that red cloak. Pain like fire lanced through the scar on his shoulder as he stared at the men, but he ignored it. The Chosen had thought you could reason with some men, but he had been wrong, and people had died for his trust. Alesh would not make the same mistake. Men like these had killed everyone he cared about, and he would make them pay. But not yet. He had promises to keep first. One of the men held his sword uncertainly and stepped forward. Alesh growled, and the man froze. Not yet, he grated, his voice harsh. But soon. The men glanced at each other as if he was mad, and that was all right. Maybe he was. Maybe they all were. He turned his back on them and slowly stalked away. The soldiers watched as he disappeared into the darkness of a nearby alleyway, fading like some phantom of blood and shadow. They did not follow. Chapter 22. Rian Tyrinin watched the dice chase each other across the table with the same rapt attention husbands reserved for their lovers or priests for their gods. Let the priests have their worship, and the nobles their mistresses, he thought, as he studied the tumbling dice. To Rian, no woman's touch was ever as enchanting, no god ever as mysterious, as divine, as a card not shown, a gamble not yet won, or, as was now the case, dice on the move. Motionless, they were nothing but small, crudely made wooden cubes with symbols etched into their sides, but once thrown, they transformed, tumbling through a world of possibilities, of chance, the depth and complexity of which sometimes left Rian nearly breathless. After what felt like an eternity, the dice came to rest, showing two ones, and that moment of excitement ended. Suddenly bored, Rian leaned forward, his thin, delicate hands dragging the coins across the table to his own growing stack.
You torch-burning cheat, Jorin growled. No one throws the god's eyes three times in a row. No one wins that much.
Rian sighed. Jorin was a big man, at least twice Rian's own size, with meaty arms and a meatier gut, compliments of the large quantities of ale he drank. Said gut was pressed tightly against the table as he leaned forward, scowling at Rian through narrowed eyes. He'd once been a soldier in Teshana's small standing army, until he'd been discharged from service. The stories people told, always out of Jorin's hearing, disagreed on the manner of the big man's dismissal from the army, but Rian suspected he knew well enough. The man had a temper like a gelded bull. He was a brawler and a drinker, but Rian didn't believe it was any of these vices that had led to him being forced to hire himself out as a guard to the Merchant's Guild. After all, of all the things that Jorin was, he was a gambler more than anything else. In Rian's estimation, it was this quality, this vice, that kept him from being a complete bore. "You know I never cheat, Jorin," he said. his voice soft and cultured despite the simple linen trousers and ragged shirt he wore.
"He's right, Jorin,"
the chubby merchant's son, Mikhail, ventured from the other side of the table, wincing as if in anticipation of a blow.
"Rion doesn't cheat. He's just got the Chosen's own luck, that's all."
Gods forbid, Rion thought. Who wanted to spend their lives ruling cities, responsible for protecting and looking after people too stupid to protect themselves? Who wanted to mediate disputes between pampered nobles, who spent their time arguing over ownership of this foothill or that wheat field, or to listen to grieving peasants complain about their cruel masters or being cheated on their wages? He wondered, not for the first time, how humans had survived as long as they had. Creatures prowled the night, killing anyone foolish enough to be out when the sun went down, and by all accounts it was getting worse, yet people couldn't see farther than their own shitty little place in the world. Not that Rion often concerned himself with such matters. In his estimation, the Night Wars had seen no victory, only a delay of the inevitable extinction of mankind, and his bet, if bets were taken on such a thing, would have been that one day the Nightlings alone would rule Entana. But that day was not yet, not now. It sat somewhere in the distant future, on the other side of many dice throws and card hands, and he made a habit of giving it no more thought than necessary. After all, he had his own shitty little place to concern himself with. He smiled at the thought, and realized it might not have been the most politic response, as Jorin scowled, bawling meaty hands the size of dinner platters into fists. Mikhail swallowed nervously, and Rion stifled a yawn as he waited. The fact that the ex-soldier felt cheated held little interest for him. Either he would decide to do something about it, or he would not, and either way presented its own possibilities. Subtly, Rion shifted so that his hand was close to the blade concealed beneath his tunic, confident that his cloak, a tattered frayed thing that he had bought from a homeless man, would hide the movement. Jorin studied him for another moment, then sat back in his chair with a grunt.
"Carry on, Mikhail, you useless bastard. It's your throw."
Rion let a small smile crease his lips and leaned forward in anticipation as the chubby man obediently picked up the dice. He didn't win another throw, but that was all right, since he was still far ahead for the night. Winning too much attracted attention, attention that a man like him couldn't afford. He knew, deep down, that he needed the money. But when the dice were rolling, when the cards were landing with ringing finality, the final product of chance determined, he always lost interest. Since he was little, it had never been the money that had interested Rion. He'd lost far more money than any of the men around him had ever owned. Perhaps, then, what intrigued him were the possibilities, the seemingly random throes of fate and chance, like some grand abstract in which a man could glimpse a deeper purpose, a deeper meaning. After all, what was life except a random throw of fate and chance? "Shit," he thought, as he waited eagerly for the next throw. "Maybe I just like to gamble." It wasn't until several hours later that he left the tavern and stepped out into the shadowed streets. By Chosen Teshana's order, large, slow-burning lanterns hung at regular intervals from poles erected for the purpose, but even the light of so many flames could not chase away the shadows that clung to the sides of the shops and the edges of the street. The Chosen had claimed that the lights were to ward off Nightlings, but as far as Rion knew, none of the creatures had ever breached the imposing walls of Valeria to enter into the city itself. Perhaps the news of attacks in Ilrica, the realm's largest city, had made the Chosen nervous. And though he wondered how the Nightwalkers managed to break through the walls of a city that was said to have even more formidable defences than Valeria, he suspected that the lights were intended to ward off the evil of men more than any creature of the night. In truth, the Chosen's efforts to eradicate crime in the city had been less than a complete success. For all her efforts, she had only really managed to widen the gap between normal criminals and the true lords of the underground. Men with wits as well as ruthlessness, men who were always long gone before the city guard arrived. Personally, Rion didn't mind. The crime bosses served a purpose. Criminals ranging from petty pickpockets to thugs, even to assassins, could all find work and a family of sorts. As long, of course, as they were willing to contribute a percentage of their earnings to the boss in question. Sure, Valeria's crime lords might not be what attracted visitors to the city, but they had their uses. Their constant infighting and the accompanying deaths helped to check any possible population problems the city might face in the future, and a man who was able to use his wits could make a fortune playing one side against the other. Besides, Rian thought as he turned down a dark alleyway, pretending not to notice the two shadows that separated themselves from the wall behind him. They make life so much more interesting. The men were good at their work, masking the sounds of their footfalls by timing them perfectly to his own, and had he not been looking for them, he doubted he ever would have seen them coming. Of course, Rian always watched the shadows, always calculated the odds, considered the possibilities in everything. He'd done so since he was a child, and years spent gambling in back-alley card games and dice rolls, where a man wagered not only his coins, but often his life as well, had only sharpened that natural tendency. The only light in the alleyway came from a lantern from the wall about halfway down. He kept his eyes turned away from it as he drew closer in order to maintain his night vision. He judged it had been a quarter hour since he'd left the tavern, long enough for his eyes to have adjusted as much as they would to the night's shadows. He continued on slowly, as if he was a man with no worries or cares in the world, as the men stalked behind him. When he drew parallel with the lantern, he lunged toward it, careful to keep his eyes away from the light, and in one motion turned and threw it at where he thought one of the two figures was. There was a shout of surprise, and the lantern shattered in a shower of bright, fiery light as one of the men swatted it out of the air with a weapon that had no doubt been intended for Rian. He kept his eyes low to the ground until the last spark of the light faded, and the men cursed.
"Where did the bastard go?"
one of the men asked. Slowly, soundlessly, Rian crept closer to the vague shapes of their shadowed outlines.
"How the fuck should I know?"
the other man growled back.
"I can't see a damn thing."
"It's the light," Rian said from beside the second man. "It wreaks havoc on the night vision." The man gasped in surprise, swinging something that, in the darkness, could have been a blade or a club. Rian ducked the clumsy, blind blow, then smashed the hilt of his dagger into the man's head. The thug let out a grunt and crumpled, Rian gliding away before he hit the ground. The other man gave a cry and lunged forward, swinging wildly, and Rian stepped smoothly to the side, keeping his breathing shallow and quiet. There was a chance the man would hear him, that he would turn and stab out, and that would be the end of it. But then, the chance was what made things interesting. Instead of swinging again, the man paused, his breathing ragged.
"Pelham?"
he asked, his voice a whisper, and in the darkness Rian could see him turning left and right, holding his weapon in front of him uncertainly, his eyes not yet adjusted to the darkness around him.
"Pelham, are you there? What in the name of the light is going on?"
"Pelham's not able to talk just now," Rian said, sidestepping the man's panicked swing. The man swung again, and this time Rian stepped forward, drawing the blade from his tunic and slashing at the man's exposed hand. The thug cried out, and his weapon clattered to the ground. Before he could recover, Rian stepped forward and kicked him in the shin hard. The man howled and fell over backward, at once trying to comfort his aching leg and wounded hand.
"Now then,"
Rian said, as he crouched down and let the bloody steel of his blade rest against the man's throat.
"I get the feeling you gentlemen wish a parley."
The man froze at the feel of the cold steel against his neck.
What the fuck are you talking about?"
he asked through gritted teeth, his bloody hand cradled against his chest. Rian sighed.
"You wanted to talk? My hand! You'll pay for that, prick! I'll see you dead!"
Rian smiled in the darkness. "We all die sooner or later," he said. "It's the one bet even a fool could win. Now, why were you following me?"
"Night take you,"
the man growled, the pain clear in his voice. Rian lowered the blade, and the man hissed as the steel kissed his neck, drawing a thin line of blood.
All right," he sputtered. "Sigyn sent us. We were supposed to remind you about the money you owe him."
Rian rubbed wearily at his temples. The thing about borrowing large sums of money from crime lords is that they always wanted it back.
"Were,"
he corrected.
"Huh?"
the man asked. Rian waved a hand dismissively.
"Forget it.
"So what?" he asked, not withdrawing the dagger. "You were supposed to rough me up a little bit, scare me into bringing his money to him?" The man grunted, as still as a statue under the cold steel. "Oh, yes, he was a professional, all right."
"Something like that. Sometimes folks forget what they owe, so Siggin sends us out to refresh their memory. We weren't going to kill you or nothing."
"No, I don't suppose you were," Rion agreed.
"Still, I consider it bad manners to sneak up on a man while he's out for a stroll, don't you?"
The man swallowed hard, his fists clenching and unclenching at his sides.
"I was just doing my job, friend. Nothing personal."
Rion nodded slowly, reaching his other hand out and grasping the short, crude club the man had carried.
"I understand. You were just doing your job, the same as a dock worker or a whore. Still, a man, like a whore, has to take responsibility for his actions, wouldn't you say?"
He felt the man tense beneath the blade.
"I'm not so—"
Rion brought the heavy club down, and the man screamed as his fingers snapped and broke like dried twigs. He jerked as if to sit up, but the blade stopped him, and he fell back down, panting heavily, his face pale and damp with sweat.
"You stupid bastard,"
he hissed through clenched teeth.
"We were just going to rough you up before, scare you a little. After this, Siggin will make sure you're a long time in dying."
"If that's the case," Rion said, leaning forward, "then I don't suppose there's much point in keeping you alive, is there?"
"Well, wait. Okay, okay. Just tell me what you want."
"How about an apology?"
"You've got to be kidding me,"
the man snarled.
"If this is a joke,"
Rion said quietly,
"then you really don't want to hear the punchline." "Fine, okay, man, whatever you say,"
he spat.
"I'm sorry, all right? I'm real fucking sorry."
Rion nodded, suddenly bored. The dice had landed, then he'd won.
"No one wins that much,"
Jorin had said. And he'd been right. A man couldn't always win. He just had to win when it mattered. He withdrew the blade and rose.
"You tell Siggin, when you see him, that the next time he sends someone after me, I'll send him back a corpse. You got it. And after that, I'm coming for him."
The man's eyes widened.
"You must be out of your damn mind. He'll ki—"
He must have seen something in Rion's eyes because he stopped, took a deep, shuddering breath, and nodded.
"I'll tell him,"
he grated.
"Good. Now get your friend and get out of here."
The man rose, cradling his ruined hand against his chest, his eyes never leaving the blade. Then he turned and stumbled toward his partner, kicking him to rouse him. The unconscious man mumbled something incoherent, then the other kicked him again, harder. He sat up then, speaking in a slow, slurred voice.
"What happened?" "Come on,"
the first man growled.
"Get on your feet. We're getting out of here."
The man stood unsteadily.
"What about the mark?" "Never mind the fucking mark. Move your ass."
Rion watched them shuffle back the way they'd come. Once he was satisfied they weren't turning around, he tossed the cudgel onto the cobbles, sheathed his dagger, and started away. He prowled the streets aimlessly for a while, taking roads and alleyways seemingly without purpose, and always watching to see if anyone was following him. When he was satisfied that he was trailed by nothing but his own shadow, long and thin in the light of the street lanterns, he turned, leaving the beggars and petty criminals of the poor quarter behind, and headed toward the northern part of the town, to the expansive mansions and elaborate houses of the noblemen and women of Valeria. He took several other roundabout paths, stopping once to get a drink at an inn before continuing on, in order to make absolutely certain no one was trailing him. Because of this, the trip took over twice the time it normally would, but it was necessary. Rion the Gambler was known in many parts of the poor district for his quiet demeanour, his cultured speech, and his almost unbelievable luck in any gamble. The few who cared enough to guess assumed that he was either a fallen priest, shunned for his inability to resist the temptation of a wager, or a failed scholar suffering from the same affliction. What they didn't guess, what Ariandrian Tyrinian would do almost anything to keep them from guessing, was that he was actually the only son and heir of one of the city's most powerful noble houses. Rion didn't know what would happen to him or his family if the entire city, the other nobles, not to mention Sigyn and the other crime lords, discovered the truth about his identity. But it was one gamble he wasn't prepared to take. Chapter 23. Once he was in the rich quarter, Rion headed toward the Golden Torch. The inn wasn't a particularly good one. The ale was watered down and the serving girls too fat for his tastes, but it had the distinct benefit of being the closest place to the poor district. Strictly speaking, it wasn't illegal for members of the poor quarter to travel the fine roads of the northern parts of the city, but patrol guards grew bored sometimes, as any man did, and legalities didn't mean a whole lot if they decided some uppity beggar needed to be shown his place. He went through the back entrance and made his way to his rented room. Once there, he changed into clothes more fitting his station, a rich blue doublet, black trousers, and a pair of fine black leather boots. He traded his tattered cloak for a full-length one of black velvet lined with fur, and fastened it on one side with a silver brooch. He studied himself in the mirror. A thin man, his mother would have said too thin, with black hair tied in a ponytail that reached past his shoulders, and a face that, he thought, could have almost been handsome if not for the sharpness of it. Still, handsome or not, there were women enough to be had if he wanted them. His family's name and their believed fortune attracted them like bees to honey. He slid the bed aside, pulled up a loose floor plank, and peered inside. Coins ranging from the small drab dusks to the larger dawns, and a dozen or so golden suns glittered back at him. He took the night's winnings, a handful of dusks, a few dawns, and a sun, and put them with the rest, wondering idly how many of the noble women who asked after him, who batted their lashes and whispered as he passed, would still do so if they knew that his family's fortune was no more real than the affection they claimed to possess. But he didn't wonder long. A man could catch bees with honey, but without it? Well, it was a big world, wasn't it? He replaced the board, slid the bed back into place, and headed out of the inn, taking the front entrance this time. Mistress Aberdeen, the owner of the inn, didn't speak or glance up from her place at the counter as he strode past her and through the nearly empty common room. As well she shouldn't, he thought sourly. The jewels the heavy-set widow so loved to wear, as well as the dresses with plunging necklines that would have appeared too forward on a woman half her age and a third her size, were paid for by that silence, by that disinterest. A short time later, he strode down the stone pathway of his family's manse, in between the rows of finely trimmed hedges, past the marble carving of several swans whose mouths acted as fountains, perpetually fluting out water. They were beautiful, but every time he looked at them, Rion could almost feel his purse growing lighter. The damned statues might spit out water, but as far as he was concerned, they drank money. Still, some facades had to be maintained, and there was no use worrying over it. The house was dark except for the light of a lantern spilling into the hallway from the open door that led to his father's study. Stifling a yawn, Rion hung his own cloak, Firmin, their manservant, having been in bed for hours gone, and started toward his room. As he tread along the richly embroidered rugs covering the floor, his mind automatically began to calculate how many dice throws, how many hands of cards, each was worth, but he cut those thoughts off with a will. He had enough worries already without depressing himself further. He was just slipping past his father's study when a voice came from inside.
"Eriandrian, is that you?"
He hesitated in the shadows, weary beyond belief, and wanting nothing but to crawl into bed and fall into a deep sleep. Finally, he reluctantly walked inside. His father was seated in a cushioned chair, the book he'd been reading draped over its arm.
"Son," the old man asked with a smile,
studying him from behind the thick spectacles he wore.
"You're in late."
Sight was not the only thing age had taken from the patriarch of Rion's house. It was said that years ago, before Rion was born, his father, Albert, had been a handsome, well-built man, and he held many trophies from his wins in tournament games. Looking at him now, a small, shriveled old man that seemed to be swallowed by the chair in which he sat, with a few wisps of grey hair on his nearly bald head, and liver-spotted hands that never ceased their trembling, Rion almost couldn't believe it.
"Hello, father,"
he said, forcing a smile past his weariness. I apologize for the hour. There was some pressing business with the latest shipment that I had to attend to.
Oh?
His father asked.
Is it anything I can help you with, my boy?
Sure, if you can find us another fortune. Know where one might be lying about? Rion shook his head.
It's fine, father. Just a small matter and easily dealt with. I can handle it.
I don't doubt that, my boy, his father said, smiling. Since you've taken over the business, you've done better than I ever did.
He met his eyes then. The roomy, nearly sightless orbs looked milky and foggy behind the spectacles he wore.
I'm proud of you, son.
Rion felt a stab of guilt. When his father had been a young man, nearly 50 years ago, he'd taken what was a small inheritance and invested it in trade, buying caravans and hiring merchants and guards to oversee land trade to other cities. Under his father's leadership, the business had prospered, and in time Albert Tyrinian had turned his meagre inheritance into a kingly fortune. 10 years ago, when Rion turned 20, and Albert's sight had grown so bad that he wasn't able to read the ledgers any more, he'd given over management of the business to his son. For a time, things had gone smoothly. Rion had always had a head for numbers and risks, but when the Nightlings began to reappear a few years ago, the business had begun to lose money despite his greatest efforts. Few were the merchants who would travel the roads with such dangers waiting in the night, and by the time Rion paid for a Lightbringer escort, he barely broke even on the trip. That, of course, wasn't considering the cost of food, guards, and the inevitable looting by bandits in the woods. The truth was, the business had hemorrhaged money for years, until finally Rion had stopped trying. He still sent caravans out from time to time, so that his father and anyone else who had a mind to look would see them, but they were always empty. Their guards paid well to look busy and keep their mouths shut. He'd refused to tell his aging father and mother about the truth, and he'd busily tried everything he could, investing what little money they had left in the best way he knew how. But nothing had worked. Nothing, that was, until Rion the Gambler was born.
"You do me too much honour, father," he said quietly. "I will never be the man you were, the man you are."
His father's gentle laughter turned into a cough. He withdrew a silk handkerchief. 2 dice throws? 3? From his tunic, with shaking hands, and for a time the only sound was that of him hacking into it. Rion frowned, struggling not to let his anxiety show.
"You shouldn't be up this late. The physicians said that you needed your rest."
His father grunted.
"It's easy for them to say. I find that the older I get, the harder it is to sleep."
He waved a hand dismissively.
"Anyway, we were speaking of you. You must not spend so much time with the business, son. You're young. You need to enjoy yourself. Find a good woman. If there's one thing I regret about my life, it's how much time I wasted working instead of spending it with you and your mother. Now," he said, leaning forward, "promise me you'll find time to enjoy yourself. You know how your mother worries."
"But I do enjoy myself, father, more than I should."
"I promise, father. Now it's late. Why don't you go to bed?" Lord Tyrinian sighed.
"I may as well try. I don't doubt I'll spend all night staring at the ceiling. But if I fall asleep in here again, your mother will have my head."
With that, he rose and headed toward the door. Before he walked through, he turned back.
"Are you sure everything's all right, son? You seem troubled."
Rion smiled.
"I'm just tired, father, that's all. Sleep well until the light returns."
His father nodded.
"Until the light returns," he said,
then turned and shuffled out the door. As soon as he left, a frown creased Rion's face. Despite the small fortune they spent on treatment, his father still seemed weak, and sometimes he forgot things. Still, the medicine that the latest, a man from the western reaches, prescribed, did seem to help, some at least. Thinking of the expensive elixir, Rion rose and glanced out a nearby window. The moon sat almost in the centre of the sky. There was still some night left, time for a few more throws, maybe a few hands of cards. He rubbed at his burning eyes and headed for the door.
Chapter 24 Alesh sank down against the side of a building and draped his hands over his knees, exhausted, numb. He'd been searching for Sonia for over 2 hours and had found nothing. His throat was scratchy and hoarse from shouting her name, and he'd lost count of the amount of corpses he'd looked at, the amount of dead eyes that had met his gaze. He noticed that his hands were shaking, and no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't make them stop. They were covered in blood from his efforts, as were the clothes he wore. If someone saw him now, they'd probably run, screaming. But what difference did that make? He hadn't seen another living soul since the group of patrolling Redeemers. He supposed that the people who hadn't gone insane in their worship of Shira, the goddess of the wild, were even now hiding in their cellars and basements, cowering behind locked doors and waiting for someone to bring order to their lives once more, waiting for the city to wake from its terrible nightmare of blood and death. A mongrel dog slunk by in the street, eyeing him warily. Something bloody was clutched in its mouth. It stopped, watching him for a moment, as if trying to decide whether or not Alesh meant to steal its hard-earned meal. Then it growled and walked away, disappearing into the haze of smoke that covered the streets like fog. "She isn't here," he muttered to himself, his voice sounding as if he'd gargled broken glass. "Can't be. Maybe she made it away. Maybe." Screams sounded in the distance, one or two blocks over, but he ignored them. He'd heard plenty this night, and he'd no doubt hear more before it was through. "You have much to answer for, Kale," he thought, as he looked around at the bloody streets, the broken windows, and broken bodies. "And answer you will, damn you," he snarled. "I'll make sure of it." Still, he suspected that things must have gotten even more out of hand than Kale had wished. After all, there wasn't much point in being the ruler of a city of corpses, was there? "He'll send troops in the morning," he thought. And even as he thought it, he knew it was true. Glancing up at the sky, he judged that there were only a few hours left before sunrise, a few hours left before the Redeemers would march into the streets in force, reinstating order at the point of their swords. That meant that Alesh had only a few hours to make it out of the city. But to do that meant leaving Sonia alone. "Don't be a fool," he told himself. The fact was, he could spend days searching through the corpses and still not find her. It was pointless. But then, what was the point in any of it? He had as much chance of making it to Valeria alone as he did of taking on the entire army of Redeemers by himself. And if somehow he did make it, what did it matter? The Chosen was dead. Abigail, Corin, all dead. But Sonia? No, that was a fool's hope. He sat, his arms propped on his knees, and considered waiting until sunrise. The Redeemers would come, and he would kill as many as he could before he died. And how many would he get? 2, 3, maybe? No. It wasn't enough. Not nearly enough. He climbed wearily to his feet and looked around. It took him a moment to get his bearings. In the smoke-filled, wasted landscape, one street looked much like any other. But finally he decided that he must be closest to the eastern gate. Indeed, he wasn't far from the place where he'd gone, what felt like years ago, to oversee the rebuilding of the hole in the wall on the Chosen's behalf. He headed toward the gate. After a few minutes, he turned a corner and was confronted with 4 men in the uniform of the Redeemers. They were gathered around an old man in a grey robe who lay curled in a ball in the street, his arms covering his head and face. They were laughing as they spat and kicked at the man, too preoccupied with their fun to notice Alesh standing a short distance away from them. He started to turn and walk away, but stopped. "I should leave him," he thought. "If I try to help, we'll most likely both be killed, and then who will warn the Chosen?" He'd taken a few steps away when an image of Corin, his friend, lying dead with his back against the wall, his body covered in his own blood, came to him. Then he thought of Abigail, the woman who'd been like a mother, lying in the street like a discarded child's doll, beaten so bad as to be almost unrecognizable. Something stirred in him then. His scar began to burn, but it was a distant thing, the feel of the sword's hilt much nearer. He drew the blade from its scabbard and stalked forward on the balls of his feet. The Redeemers were still beating on the old man, and didn't notice him until a foot of steel exploded from the chest of the first, showering the others in blood. They cried out in shock and surprise, and were reaching for their blades, when Alesh's blade hacked into the neck of the next closest. Blood fountained from the wound, covering him, as the man's head flew from his body and rolled several feet before finally coming to a stop on the cobbled street. Alesh brought up his blade, barely managing to deflect a strike that had been aimed at his own head. The man started to pull back for another swing, but Alesh lunged forward, calling on all of the speed and strength he'd gained from countless hours of training under the Chosen's tutelage, and slammed his fist into the man's throat. The soldier's blade clattered to the ground as he grabbed his throat with both hands, his eyes bulging. Faintly, Alesh could hear someone screaming, but he didn't spare it any thought as he stepped forward and unceremoniously rammed the blade through the man's heart. He jerked the sword free in a spray of blood, and turned to the last man. The soldier, a youth of no more than 18 years, watched him with wide, frightened eyes. As Alesh moved toward him, the Redeemer dropped his weapon and held both of his hands up before him.
"Please,"
the youth stumbled, his face pale.
"I didn't mean—"
His words cut off, as Alesh's sword licked out, and in seconds another head rolled along the cobbles. Alesh swayed on his feet, staring at the corpses, and the screams continued to echo in his ears. It wasn't until his throat began to burn as if it was on fire that he realized the screams were his own. He stopped then, expecting the guilt, the shame of what he'd done to overwhelm him. It did not come. 4 men who'd been breathing moments before, who'd laughed and talked and had lives, men with mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, and he felt nothing more than the rawness in his throat and an ache in his hand where he held the handle of the sword in a white-knuckled grip. "Later," he told himself, though he didn't believe it. "I'll feel it later." He wiped the blade clean on one of the red cloaks and slid it back into the scabbard at his waist. Then he shuffled to the old man and rolled him onto his back, but instead of the dead, vacant gaze that he'd expected, the man's eyes, a blue so dark that they were almost black, stared back at him through a mask of blood. "No," Alesh thought, "not at me, but at something." The man's gaze was distant, clouded, and he didn't seem to see Alesh at all. It was as if he was instead staring into some other world, some other place where perhaps there were no streets that smelled of smoke and death, no bodies of children littering the alleyways. The man's gaze was so steady, so level, that Alesh started to think he was dead after all, and it wasn't until he noticed the almost imperceptible rise and fall of the old man's chest that he was sure he was alive. "Are you okay?" As soon as the words were out of his mouth, he realized how stupid they sounded. Of course the man wasn't okay. He'd been nearly beaten to death by 4 men for no other reason than they happened across him in the street.
"Well, why?"
the man asked. Alesh started to ask him what he meant, when he realized that the man wasn't speaking to him at all. Perhaps he spoke to someone in that other world upon which he looked. Alesh glanced around at the corpses that littered the street, then back at the old man. "Listen, you'd best go home. Sooner or later someone else is bound to come along and, well, it's just probably best that you go home."
"You're wrong,"
the man croaked.
"Please,"
he said, his eyes filling with tears.
"It isn't too late. Please."
Alesh was surprised by the sympathetic clutch in his chest and the tears that gathered in his own eyes as he watched the man's suffering. He thought himself incapable of any more sadness. He'd been wrong. Perhaps the god's greatest cruelty was that no matter how much suffering men endured, they still felt each new hurt as if it was the first. Taking in the man's distant, absent stare, and the way his hands groped for something that wasn't there, Alesh was reminded of a time, a few years ago, when there'd been a tournament in Nilrika, and one of the knights had caught a hard, square hit on his helmet with a lance during a joust. He'd lived, after a fashion, but he'd never been right in the head, always talking to people who weren't there in sentences that were as nonsensical as the old man's. He wondered if this man, too, had been made a simpleton by one of the blows he'd taken. "It won't matter one way or the other if you let him bleed to death," he scolded himself. The man didn't seem aware of his hurts, but he was still bleeding freely from a deep gash on his forehead, and one of his thin arms was clearly broken. "I'll be right back," he said, but if the man heard, he gave no sign. Alesh shuffled to one of the nearby redeemers and tore strips from the dead man's cloak before walking back to the old man. He used one of the makeshift bandages to wipe the blood away from the old man's face, then tied a strip tightly around the man's forehead. The old man was silent while he worked. Even when Alesh used several of the long strips of linen to wrap around his shoulder and arm in a makeshift sling, even when he forced the man's arm back into place, he did not cry out. "He's farther gone than I realized," he thought, as he finished tying the knots together. When he was finished, he glanced up at the sky and saw that the moon had sunken considerably. An hour, maybe two. "Listen," he said, "I've got to go." He waited several seconds, but still the man didn't answer. Alesh had been forced to pull him to a sitting position to put on the sling, and the old man sat there unmoving, as dead to the world as if he had been killed. "I should have left them to their work," he thought. "It would have been a mercy." I'm sorry," he murmured. "I have to go. I have to tell Tashana what happened to Olimon." The man's eyes snapped into focus then, and his gaze whipped to Alesh, who recoiled at the intensity, the gravity of that gaze.
"Olimon,"
the man rasped.
"He's dead."
Alesh froze at the words. How could he know that? Then, "Of course he'd know, you fool. News travels fast, and bad news fastest of all, as Abigail used to say." Thinking of the head cook made his throat grow tight, and it was all he could do to nod. The man let out a heavy sigh, his head and shoulders drooping. He sat that way for so long that Alesh became convinced that he'd fainted. Just when he was considering whether or not to leave the man unconscious in the street, whether or not he could, the man spoke.
"Then it has begun."
Alesh felt a chill at the words, the same words that Olimon himself had used only the day before. Coincidence? Surely. It had to be, but suddenly he didn't want to be here, talking to this man. For reasons he didn't fully understand himself, he was terrified of what the old man might say. Yet he could not stop himself from asking. "What do you mean?" The old man gave no answer, and his gaze grew distant and unfocused once more. "What has begun?" Alesh asked again. "Damn it, what do you mean?" The man gave no sign that he heard, and Alesh sighed heavily. "And what did you expect? He's half mad from his injuries, that's obvious. He's just spouting nonsense, nothing more. And while you're wasting time here, sunrise is coming." Judging by the man's grey robes, Alesh suspected he was one of Amidan's priests. With the Redeemers patrolling the streets, it wouldn't be long before they found him, and then... "You can't help him," he told himself. "You can't even help yourself." Everyone that Alesh had cared for, except perhaps for Sonya, had died, and it was his fault. If he'd have told the Chosen about seeing Kale speaking with Phelan Parr, if he hadn't have told Corin to go to the town square, they might still be alive now. He rubbed at the scar on his shoulder. Abigail had told him that he wasn't cursed, that it was only a foolish thing said by foolish people. She had been wrong. "I'm sorry," he muttered again. "I can't help you." "I can't help anyone." With that, he turned and started down the street. He did not look back.
Chapter 25. He'd only gone a short distance when he heard the sound of footsteps behind him. He turned and saw that the old man was limping after him, his face showing no sign of the agony he had to be feeling. He waited, curious, as the old man shuffled up beside him, then stopped, staring at him with an expectant expression. "You don't want to follow me," Alesh said, unable to keep the bitterness from his voice. "Whatever you do, you don't want to do that." Though the man's expression didn't change, something about his eyes did, and for a moment Alesh was reminded of the Chosen himself, of those looks he'd given on those occasions when he'd scolded him. He waited,
expecting the man to say something, but he remained silent.
"I mean it,"
he said again, his voice little more than a whisper.
"You're better on your own."
He took a few more steps and was annoyed to find that the man was following him once more.
"Damn you,"
he said, stopping and turning to face the man. "Why won't you leave me alone? Look, if you think you owe me something for saving you, you don't. I didn't do it for you. I did it..." He paused as the faces of the dead flew through his mind.
"I did it because I wanted them dead. I want all of them dead."
The Chosen would have said that there was good in all men, that they only sought the opportunity to show it, and Abigail would have taken her spoon to him, grown or not. But Abigail was dead. The Chosen was dead, and everything that he'd built had died with him. "And I'm left alone. Always alone."
"Fine," he decided.
"If he wants to follow me, let him.
What difference does it make?"
He thought of Sonia.
What chances did a little girl have when the whole world had gone mad? What chance did anyone have?
And what had Erwin expected? For Alesh to be a hero? For him to save the city? He couldn't even save a little girl who had depended on him. He noticed that the old man was still watching him, and he grunted angrily.
"Do what you want," he said. "It doesn't matter anyway."
He started off in the direction of the eastern gate, concentrating on nothing but putting one foot in front of the other. In time, the path on which he travelled would lead him to Valeria, or, more likely, to his death. He found that, at that moment, he didn't care much which. Chapter 26. Someone screamed in the distance, and Sonia tensed, hugging her knees tightly to her chest. Fresh tears gathered in her eyes, and she rubbed at them with an angry fist. Abigail had told her to be brave, and she wanted to. She really did. But her back and legs hurt, and even though she knew that the inn in which she hid was empty, she kept thinking she heard the footsteps of the men in the red cloaks, kept thinking that one was sneaking up on her where she hid under the bar's counter. She was being dumb. Of course she knew that, just as she knew that there wasn't anyone in the inn except her. She'd been here for hours, after all, and if someone was here, they'd have already got her. She knew she was alone, but what if she wasn't? What if the men were sitting at one of the tables, maybe, or standing at the counter, just waiting for the dumb little girl to come crawling out so they could grab her? She whimpered as a cramp began to spread in her leg and rubbed at it furiously. She knew she needed to get up, to stretch her legs and aching back, but every time she started to, she remembered the men in the square, remembered the way they'd climbed onto the stage swinging their swords, remembered the actors screaming as blood, real blood, not the red ribbons they used on their play, flew across the stage in great big streaks, like paint. She'd stared, unable to believe what was happening, until Abigail had grabbed her up and started running away from the square. But everyone in the crowd was trying to run too, bumping into each other, knocking each other down. She saw several people disappear under the feet of the crowd, but no one stopped to help them up. After what felt like years, they made it to the edge of the crowd, but the men in the red cloaks were there too, hitting people with their swords. Two of them came toward her and Abigail, but then Corin was there, swinging his own sword and knocking both the men down like a knight out of one of the stories Abigail told her when she couldn't sleep.
"Get out of here!"
he'd shouted, swinging his sword at some other soldiers that had come to help their friend. Sonia wanted to stay and help, but Abigail had grabbed her again, and they were running down an alley when something hit Abigail and she fell over. Sonia looked and saw a stick poking out of Abigail. She went to grab it, but the head cook had screamed at her.
"Sonia, you have to run, baby. Be brave and run."
So she had. She'd always been good at running. Alesh said she was as fast as a rabbit when she wanted to be. She ran until her chest burned and her legs ached, and then she ducked into the same inn she was in now and hid under the counter. She'd been there ever since. She knew she should do something, but she didn't know what. Abigail had told her to run, and she had, but she thought even rabbits couldn't run all the time. She wished Alesh was here. Alesh always knew what to do. He was brave, too.
Alesh wouldn't have hidden under a counter like a fraidy cat chicken, too scared to crawl out and stretch his legs and back. Besides, she was hungry, and if she didn't get something to eat soon, the men in red cloaks would find her just from hearing her stomach growling. But she didn't know if there was any food in the inn, and if there was, where to find it. And what if one of the men found her when she was looking? She let out a whimper of frustration. Abigail always said that nothing got done until you started doing it. But what was she supposed to do? In the stories, the princesses always knew what to do. If you saw a toad wearing a crown, then you kissed him, and then he became a prince, and then you kissed him. Of course, kissing a toad was gross, and kissing a prince didn't seem much better, but at least the girls in the stories did something. The stories always talked about how wise and brave and smart they were, about the wise and brave and smart things they did. As far as Sonya knew, there were no stories about little girls who hid under counters until they were old girls with grey hair and warts on their noses. "Be brave," Abigail had told her, and she would be. She took a slow, deep breath, and was just beginning to work her way out from beneath the counter when she heard the sound of approaching voices. Holding her breath, she crawled back into the shadowed corner. Moments later, the door swung open, and the fitful light of a lantern chased shadows across the walls over Sonya's head. "I told you we shouldn't have come here," a woman's voice said. "The whole city's gone insane. Oh, don't give me that look. Anyway, at least we've lost them for now. I don't think... Wait. What is it? Where are you going?" There was the sound of soft, measured footsteps, and Sonya's breath caught in her throat. A moment passed, then another, and she was just about to dare to breathe when a face, wreathed in shadow, appeared only inches in front of her. She screamed as hands grabbed her and pulled her out of her hiding place.
"Please don't hurt me," she stammered,
telling herself to be brave, but crying anyway. The stranger sat her on the counter, and in the dancing light of the lantern, he sat down beside her. She saw that his skin was a light brown, like chocolate. The man smiled a smile that reached all the way to his eyes, and despite her terror, Sonya found her sobs slowing, then stopping altogether.
"Dahl?"
the woman asked, as she walked over to stand beside the man.
"What's going on?"
She looked at Sonya, and her eyes went wide with what appeared to be concern.
"Oh, light save us! Honey, are you all right?"
Sonya looked at the woman, and her breath caught in her throat again, not with fear this time, but with wonder. The woman was beautiful. Her skin was smooth, her eyes green like the grass in the castle courtyard. She had long blonde hair that tumbled around her head as she leaned in to wipe away Sonya's tears.
"Oh, are you a princess?"
Sonya asked breathlessly. The woman laughed. It was a lilting, musical laugh, and Sonya smiled hesitantly.
"No, precious, I'm not a princess. In fact, I guess I'm about as far from one as you can get. My name's Catherine, but you can call me Cat. How about you? A little girl as beautiful as you are. Why, if you're not a princess, then the world's gone crazier than I thought."
Sonya felt herself blush.
"I'm Sonya. I'm not a princess, but I do live at a castle."
She paused, then, swallowing past a lump in her throat,
"Or I did before."
"I know, honey," the woman said, running a gentle hand through Sonya's hair.
"I know. Listen."
She cut off at the sound of someone shouting in the street.
"Night, take them,"
the woman breathed as she turned to the man.
"They must have heard her scream. It won't be long before they check here. We have to go." "But please don't leave me,"
Sonya blurted, surprising herself. Abigail had told her to never go anywhere with strangers, but suddenly the thought of being alone again, of being left behind by this man with the smiling eyes and the woman with the voice like music, terrified her.
I'll be good, I promise. I do. "Oh, honey,"
the woman said, hugging her in her arms and picking her up.
"Of course we're not going to leave you." "Really?"
Sonya asked tentatively.
"You promise?"
The woman smiled.
"I promise, sweetie."
She turned to the man, Sonya still in her arms.
"We've got to go. What do you want to do?"
The man pointed at the two of them, then to the door at the inn's back entrance. The woman nodded and started toward the door.
Wait,
Sonya stammered, suddenly scared.
He's not coming, because the mean men will get him. They got Corin and Abigail.
The woman smiled.
It's all right, sweet one. He'll catch up soon enough. Dahl has a way of dealing with mean men.
The dusky-skinned man, Dahl, smiled and winked at her. Another shout came from outside, much closer than the first had been, and he looked at Catherine and raised an eyebrow.
Right,
the woman said. We'll head toward the southern gate. The man nodded and started toward the door. The shadows seemed to shift and stir around him as he moved. Then he opened the main door of the inn and disappeared into the night.
All right, Sonya, the woman, Cat, said. I need you to be brave and quiet. Can you be brave?
Sonya didn't want to go outside. The men in the red cloaks were outside. But Abigail had told her to be brave. She nodded against the woman's shoulder, not trusting herself to speak. The woman hugged her tightly for a second, then sat her down.
Don't you worry, Sonya, she said,
holding her hand, and leading her toward the back door of the inn.
Everything's going to be fine.
Chapter 27 Alesh breathed a weary sigh of relief. Finally. The smoke wasn't as bad here, closer to the edge of the city, and he could make out the western gate in the distance. He'd been forced to take several back alleys and side streets, avoiding groups of soldiers as well as one group of bloody, dishevelled townsfolk who ran and growled like animals on the hunt. He turned to look behind him and shook his head in disbelief. Somehow, despite his injuries, the old priest had managed to keep pace with him and, if anything, seemed to be in better shape than Alesh himself. He waited as the old man came to stand beside him. "We need to find a light-bringer," Alesh said, mostly to himself. "That is, if there are any left who haven't gone mad or fled the city." The old man cocked his head to the side.
"Torch-bearers?"
Alesh sighed. The torch-bearers had been the elite troops of the Chosen during the Night War, the toughest, most skilled soldiers of their time. That time, of course, was long past, and by now they were all dead and gone, but he didn't have time to try to explain that to the old man. Not that it would do much good. The man might be surprisingly fast for an injured old priest, but it was obvious that the beating he'd taken had left him without his wits.
"Come on,"
Alesh said, not bothering to see if the priest followed, as he started down the street. This far from the center of the city, the streets were empty of the living, but the dead were there in their multitudes. They lay scattered across the road, their mouths slack, their faces twisted in expressions of terror and agony so intense that even death had not quelled it. A sharp twinge of pain went through his hand, and he glanced down, surprised to see that he held the bare sword in a white-knuckled grip. He started to put the blade away, but decided against it. There didn't seem to be anyone around, but a person could never know when their death was coming. The dead, were they able, would have no doubt said as much. Slowly, stepping carefully so as to avoid disturbing the sprawled corpses, Alesh began making his way toward a large building on the side of the street. The Lightbringers' Guildhouse was a plain, unassuming wooden building, differing from the humble dwellings of the poor districts surrounding it only in its size. It was a sprawling two-story structure, several times larger than an average inn. Not surprising, really, considering the fact that it was said to house the majority of Ilrika's lightbringers, while, at the same time, providing a shelter for those from other cities whose profession brought them to Ilrika. Some of the city's lightbringers lived in homes of their own, with families of their own, but such men and women were the minority. The life expectancy of a lightbringer was about what one might expect of men and women who spent their days handling chemicals and herbs that could set a man on fire in an instant, and their nights surrounded by nightwalkers with nothing to keep them at bay but their own skill. This, coupled with the fact that a lightbringer's fortune, however large or small, always reverted to the guild upon his or her death, and it was no wonder that so few of them had families. Still, the guild members did enjoy certain privileges, and those they enjoyed equally. No matter a man's status in society, commoner or noble, he resigned it upon entering the guild, and not even the most arrogant of noblemen was foolish enough to offend the Lightbringers. After all, a man could never be certain when he might need to seek their services. The Guildhouse was a place of equality, a symbol of man's fight against the darkness, a beacon of hope for those who looked